Okay, so the doctorate, full profs 10, associate profs 7,500, assistant profs 4,000, something like that. Don't take the cut the salaries of secretaries at all. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this to the trustees with a copy to Mackey. This is the way to do it. No response. And the way they did it was they cut everybody's secretaries and everybody else. I forget what the percent was, but it was a, it was similar to this, what's this tax proposal nowadays?
The flat tax?
It was like a flat tax. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Well, not very progressive in any way.
Definitely not progressive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had one guy who was on the board of trustees back in the 60s who was the... He was the regional director of the telephone company for southeastern Michigan or some mm-hmm. such place. And I used to go to the Board of Trustees meetings looking for material for columns, and I always managed to get some up there. Well, one time I went to one, I used to sit right near the president. There's sort of a gallery there. And so if you took a picture, sometimes with the board, I'd be in the picture. One time I was in a picture wearing a tie-dyed t-shirt. So anyway, I was sitting in my usual place one time. Everybody's at the table, the president sitting in the chair, all the trustees and all the other people who were at the table were there in place. Claire White came in, and he was going to sit right next to the president, and he motioned to me, come on over. So I get up. Figured everybody's wondering, what the hell is this guy up to? We go out of the room, cross the hall, go into another room. He says, Lash, I'm going to introduce a motion that the president's chair is vacant. What do you think of that? And I don't know. I said, that's a great idea, Claire. Why don't you do that? Well, he never did do it. He was just trying to freak out people. Uh-huh. But I don't know why I brought that up. It just came back to mind.
Do you think the economic problems had a lot to do with President Mackey's difficulties?
No. Oh, he was asked by the state news, are you going to follow the example of the president of Wayne State and cut your salary? He said, no, I definitely am not. He said, if the university can't pay me what I'm worth, I leave, go elsewhere. See, that's what I mean by no leadership. Because mm-hmm. that was a demoralizing thing to do. The flat tax way of cutting everybody, regardless of how much money they made.
Or secretaries.
It was cruel so far as secretaries were concerned, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. No, he's a classic example to me of a guy who starts out in life as poor and just can't get enough money to ensure that he'll never slide back into poverty. You see that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. A classic example that I used to talk about in my labor class was a guy named Dave Beck, who was the president of the Teamsters, national president, and he was forced out of office because he took a 15, this guy was a millionaire. See, he got tips from business people on good investments and so on. I don't think he stole money from the union. I think he parlayed his salary. He lived modestly, and he played the market, in effect, with real estate tips and whatnot.
With insider information.
Almost. Yeah, insider information. But he got thrown out of office because a $1,500 check that was supposed to go to the widow, a pension check, to the widow of one of the officers of the union who had died, he took the check and used it for some business enterprise that somebody had recommended to him, mm-hmm. and he was going to pay it back, but he mm-hmm. apparently hadn't by the time the union's convention occurred. And when the people at the convention were all hand-picked people, it wasn't a democratic organization, but when they found out that he had done that, they were so appalled, they threw him out of office. Mm-hmm. Now, see, that's what... Why would somebody do something like it? Jeopardize his whole damn career mm-hmm. for a pittance? Mm-hmm. One explanation would be, if you start out in poverty, you may spend your whole life fearing that you're going to slide back into poverty, so you accumulate as much money and property as you can, as insurance that you won't slide back into poverty. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me explains Mackey's behavior. See, he was He was not popular with the Board of Trustees. He wasn't all that popular with the faculty either. He managed to antagonize within about a year every group the university depends on. Farmers, state legislature, alumni association, called in the head of the alumni association, who probably should have been bounced, but called him in, clear out your office by 5 p.m. The guy says, you can't fire me. The Board of Trustees of the alumni association can, but you can't. Well, it took Mackey about a year to get this guy fired. And in all that time, there's constant stories in the state news and the state journal about this struggle between the new president to get rid of this guy. Now, Mackey told me one time that when he took the job, he was told by the Board of Trustees, one thing he wants you to do is straighten up the alumni association. They are a drain on our finances when they ought to be raising money for the university. So he took that seriously, but look at the way he went about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't have the power to do something, you shouldn't act as if you do, because it's going to undermine your credibility if you do that. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by not understanding leadership.
Mm-hmm. So you obviously had some contact with Dr. DiBiagio too, just before you retired.
Just a letter exchange of letters. Mm-hmm. About mandatory retirement, and then see, that was long in the past when they needed somebody to fill in the grievance office, and he called me up. Mm-hmm. And said he was going to appoint me. So I felt friendly with him. Uh-huh. And who the hell followed him?
And that's President McPherson. Well, Gordon Guyer was interim.
Gordon Guyer. Yeah. I never had any dealings with him. Mm-hmm. I remember going to see him one time, and I can't remember why. But I made some comment to the effect that if he needed a stand-in, I was available because we were both bald. And he seemed like a pretty friendly guy to me.
Mm-hmm. And have you had any contact with our current president?
Well, indirectly. McPherson? Mm-hmm. If I'm introduced to you something called the Williams case, does that bring back your memory?
Yes, some. But can you? Not that. You have to get into the details of that, but I don't know if that's still going on.
Oh no, that was resolved.
Yeah. Okay.
And that was a very satisfying experience for me, because here was this guy in microbiology who was victimized by one of his former employees, and he expected the administration to support him and to order this former employee to return some research materials that she had taken out of the refrigerator in his lab, and she wouldn't do it. And the administration, instead of telling her either return those materials or you're out, turned on him, started punishing him, put him on 9 months instead of 12 months, for example. That's a substantial salary cut, mm-hmm. And in effect, we're hounding him. So He had supporters, and he had people who didn't care much for him. You could say he was arrogant, I think, in a hard-driving guy. And you know how somebody who works himself to the bone expects people working for him to work themselves to the bone. They don't have the same incentive he has, but lots of people don't appreciate that. And he had that kind of a reputation, too. But he was right, in my opinion, and the administration was completely wrong. I think the reason they supported this woman who stole those, these were, when I say research materials, these were tissue samples, mm-hmm. taken from people in the Sudan to study to see if there's some way river blindness could be prevented or treated. That's what his project mm-hmm. was. And she had taken these tissue samples out of his lab here, where they were being kept for study, and put them in her own refrigerators someplace, and she wouldn't return them. Mm-hmm. And he kept trying to get the administration to order her to do so. They wouldn't do it and all that. So he had a group of about five or six microbiologists and people over in the med school area there who were trying to help him get this thing resolved in his favor, and they weren't getting anywhere. So somebody suggested to him that maybe I could be of help. I think by this time I was retired. I was, because I was at home recovering from a complete knee replacement. That's
okay. Excuse me just a second.
And he told me about all this, and so the upshot was I met with this committee, and they struck me as well-intentioned guys who had no idea of how to approach trying to get this remedied, how to put pressure on the administration, is what it comes down to.
You weren't FGO at this time?
No, I was retired.
Oh, you were retired?
Was oh, 93, and I was retired in 89.
Okay.
So anyway, I thought, here's an outrage that I should try to help resolve if I could. So I met with these people from time to time. And one of the things we did was take out a full-page ad in the state news urging the president, who it was, I think it was DiBiagio at the time, but he was on his way, he was leaving, mm-hmm. and he left before this thing got underway, really, but urging the administration to meet with Williams and a committee of people from the medical sciences and try to resolve this. And we got people to sign that, and we got a lot of prestigious people from the medical field to sign that ad. Oh, I don't know, the first full-page ad, we tried to minimize the amount of text, and so it left quite a bit of space for signatures. We must have had a couple hundred signatures for that one. That didn't get us anywhere. The provost would not meet with him or with this committee of scientists, and I said to these people, don't put my name on the committee going to deal with her, because she'll figure I'm a troublemaker. Mm-hmm. So leave me off, but you guys are in the same area, so you'd be the proper people to meet with. No response from the provost or the president. Took out another full-page ad. Didn't do any work. Took another half-page ad saying, here is what Williams would find acceptable, and it was a modest set of requirements. So why don't you agree to those and get this thing resolved? And that was signed by, I think about 300 people. And we're not getting anywhere. Well, then, I'm really desperate trying to figure out what the hell can we do? I thought when you took out those full-page ads, there'd be an uprising of the faculty in general at this shabby treatment of one of their faculty by the administration. Didn't happen. So I'm sitting at home trying to figure out if we could do something else when I got a call from a guy named Sam Riddle. Riddle he's a lawyer now. He was a student here in the 60s. He's an African American. He was the leader of militant blacks while he was a student. Sit-ins and that sort of thing. A very creative guy when it comes to exerting pressure on somebody. And he has continued to do that sort of thing even after graduating. He went down to U of M Law School from here and led a campaign which asking the university down there to recruit black students until they constituted 10% of the student body. They now have about 15% mm-hmm. blacks in the student body. So he's a creative guy. He knows how to do things. So he was passing through town. His home is in Virginia now, and he participates in, he'll be a campaign manager for somebody running for political office, that kind of thing. He'll make videos that are shown on television, that kind of thing. So he's going through town, and he thought, I haven't seen that guy LaRue for a long time. I used to be a supporter of these militant blacks when he was here. He remembered that. So he called me and asked me, what are you doing, and so on. I said, well, I think you'll be interested in what I'm doing. So I told him, he said, if you would like, he said, I'll come back. I'm going over to Flint where his family lives. I'll be back tomorrow. You get this guy, Williams, and some of this committee, and I'll meet with you and we'll discuss what we can do. So he did, and they met at my place. And here I am recovering from this damn knee operation. And and I showed him these ads we had taken and things we tried to do, and he said, well, he said, what you guys have done so far is pretty good, he said, but it hasn't gotten anywhere. And the reason it hasn't is you missed the main point of all this. So, you know, and that's what the hell is this main point? He says, what you're up against is institutional racism. that's what you've got to make your argument about. I said, well, what the hell, how do we do that? And he said, here's the situation you've got. You've got a professor at Michigan State who's conducting research in the Sudan in an attempt to find a cure and a preventive of river blindness, which is rampant in the Sudan. And you're being, and this prof is being, is not getting the support of the administration. We've got a black chairman of the Board of Trustees. We've got black officials throughout the university. They are blocking an effort on the part of this prof to cure river blindness. And what you've got to point out is, if these people were white, they'd probably be supporting this prof, and they'd be looking for a cure for river blindness, but because they're blacks in the Sudan, they're not. It's something along that line. That was it. So I said, how are we going to get this point to the attention of the people who can do something about it? Well, he said, I happened to be friendly with Joel Ferguson. He was the chairman of the board at that time. They were both active in the Jesse Jackson presidential campaign. I think co-chaired the state committee for Jackson, something like that. He says, I'm going to call him, and I'm going to tell him that, no, I'll write him a letter. And I think he and I wrote it together, and I think he signed it. But we'll get in touch with Joel Ferguson, and we'll point out to him that if he doesn't instruct the administration to straighten this thing out, there's a group of faculty here who are prepared to go public with a denunciation of the administration and Joel Ferguson, and they'll argue that you have no damn bit of Ferguson, have no business running for the Senate, which he was in the primary, when you allow this thing to go on this way. And see, I was all for it. I was going to do that. And I think the guys in the medical field, they would have signed something like that too. Well, that didn't work. So he went down to see. No, he called Ferguson when he found out from Ferguson's assistant that Ferguson was not moved by all this. So we went down and talked to him. And Ferguson said, look, he said, I know something about that Williams case. And he said, I'm not going to, he just wants publicity. Well, that's a totally ridiculous statement. And he said, furthermore, he says, he picked up a stick and he hit me with it. Well, what that meant was, Williams had filed a suit in court trying to get the university to do something about this problem, and he'd filed it against the trustees and the administration, which included Ferguson as a member of the board. That's what he meant. He'd beating me over the head with this lawsuit. Mm-hmm. That was when Riddle threatened that this group of faculty were going to go public with all this. I think the next day, Ferguson's administrative assistant called Riddle and said, Ferguson would like to talk with you. So he went down and talked to him. And Sam said, all you have to do as chairman of the board is tell Ferguson to settle this damn case, and it's going to be settled. Mm-hmm.
Or tell McPherson?
McPherson, he was president by that time. And see, we had been trying to make the argument to McPherson, you inherited this problem. You have no ego involvement in all this. Mm-hmm. His answer was, I want to get the lie of the land here before I get involved in any controversies like this. So I could understand McPherson's position. But when Ferguson was threatened, he that got his attention. And I can't swear to this because I wasn't present, but my understanding of all this is, and it makes sense because of the short time span involved, once Ferguson decided to act, he called up McPherson, said, why don't you meet with Williams and settle it? McPherson called Williams and said, I think this controversy has gone on long enough. Why don't you come over to Cole's house at 7 o'clock tonight, and you and I will settle this between ourselves. And it was settled on precisely the terms we'd been putting in those ads. Mm-hmm. It took about 15 minutes or so at Cole's house to do that. Mm-hmm. I was really proud of that. Mm-hmm. And to me, see, that's casting your bread upon the waters and it comes back to you, because And here again, you've got coincidence. If I hadn't supported blacks in the 60s, Sam Riddle wouldn't have called me up in 1989 or 93.
Because you were the faculty advisor for his group at that
time? No, no, no. I just supported him in columns and so on. Mm-hmm. I wrote several columns on the subject of racial discrimination, which they liked. You familiar with the name Saul Alinsky? He was a guy who he lived in Chicago. He was a master at figuring out ways to put pressure on people in authority who wouldn't talk to him. One case was, it had to do with the blacks in Chicago, and they tried to get an audience with Mayor Daley, the father of the current mayor, who wouldn't talk to him. So Alinsky called a meeting of blacks, Chicago blacks, and he said, now here's the way we're going to get Daley's attention. Or I think he asked, what is Daley most proud of that has come about during his administration? It turned out to be O'Hare Airport, as I remember it. So he said, here's the way we get his attention. We go out there, we recruit a large number of blacks, we got to the airport, we go into all the men's and women's lavatories, and when people get off the airplane where they've been waiting to land so they can relieve themselves and they head for the John, it's wall to wall us. Alinsky knew that there is always somebody in the crowd who's going to go right to Daley, or the guy you're trying to pressure, and tell him you better do something about this. And so that got Daley's attention, and I said, God, if I could just think of something creative like that, but I couldn't. Mm-hmm. But it worked out just fine, thanks to, I'd call that throwing your bread on the waters. Mm-hmm. It comes back to you.
In looking back at your career at Michigan State.
I got one more. One more. Incident. Can you stand it?
Sure, of course.
Hold that thought. Sometime in the early 90s, I guess, a Japanese national student, came to see me, and the guy could barely speak English. He was like a caricature of a Japanese. He pronounced my name Rash Ralu. I had to ask him to repeat everything he said to me. His accent was so god-awful. He was an electrical engineering grad student, I think. And he informed me that he was the head of something called Box Office Spectaculars. And they were showing porn films in Wells Hall. Mm-hmm. And they had been told by Turner, who was vice president for student affairs, you can't show them anymore. So would I be their faculty advisor? So I said, yeah, sure. So I'm now their faculty advisor. So Turner is shutting them down. And so we went to the ACLU and we got ourselves over in federal court over in Grand Rapids arguing that this was an unconstitutional deprivation of their First Amendment rights to show the film and for people who wanted to see him to see him. So that resulted in a big pompous guy from the Hannigan Miller, that's the premier law firm in Detroit, $500 an hour kind of thing. This guy shows up over in the court there and we're there and we have to wait in a room together. This guy from Detroit is throwing his weight around and et cetera. And the upshot of it was, the ACLU lawyer argued, well, first, we had a lawyer from here who went over there, and he went into a huddle with this lawyer representing the university, and they concocted an idea that's an absolute outrage. It was going to be a committee composed of students and faculty and administrators who would preview films, Box Office Spectaculars wanted to show, and if they were acceptable, they could be shown. If they weren't, they wouldn't show up. Well, it's censorship, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So we dropped this lawyer, and we got a lawyer from Grand Rapids. And he informed the judge, who I could see didn't want to deal with this case because of the First Amendment aspect of it, that this case didn't belong in federal court. It belonged in state court under the Michigan obscenity law, which is enforced by the attorney general and or the local prosecutor. So the judge was so relieved he threw the case out. And then it turned out the attorney general didn't want to mess with it, and nor did any local prosecutor.
So that was the origin of the
Well, then see, the happy ending to that story was, once they got the green light to show the films, it turned out not enough students wanted to see it to cover the cost of renting the films, so it just died a natural death. But I was dying to get into court and have this Japanese guy on the stand and this pompous lawyer trying to ask him questions and then, you know, be unable to understand him. But I was deprived of that when the case got thrown out.
When you came here in 1956, did you anticipate you'd spend your entire career at Michigan State?
No, I thought I'd go back to the West Coast somehow. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I grew up in Portland and lived in Seattle for 13 years, and 18 years in Portland, 13 years in Seattle, and 5 years or so down in Santa California. I figured I can't live anywhere but the West Coast, but I never got a decent job offer, so I finally reconciled myself to staying here, and I've been, I haven't been unhappy about that at all. It's been great.
What have you seen as, from your view and your experience, Michigan State, how has it changed over the years? What do you see as maybe the strong point, or in a sense dealing with the issue of why you stayed?
Well, Michigan State used to pride itself on the quality of undergraduate teaching. See, that's gone now, because once a university becomes determined to be a research university, which we have decided we want to be, and tries to compete in the field of research, etc., with the U of M, teaching is going to go by the boards. Now, you know, I know that people will say, well, there's no necessary conflict between a prof being a teacher and a researcher. That's true, and research can enrich teaching. I'm familiar with all that. But the fact of the matter is, research universities are notorious all over the country for slighting undergraduate teaching. There are all kinds of reports by experts on that. I think I wrote a column one time, the Ann Arborization of Michigan State. See, attacking that idea, of course, falling on deaf ears. I think that's unfortunate. Our comparative advantage was in undergraduate teaching, whereas U of M's advantage is in research and publication. So for us to try to compete with them in that way, to me, it's a terrible mistake. And we've lost one quality that made this an attractive place for students to come and get a good education. So I think, and this all preceded McPherson, his arrival with this, what's the bottom line approach to running a university, and how would a corporation handle the employees and so on? That just
students as customers,
the downhill speed. Yeah, students are customers. Think of the implication of students are customers. You give a student a bum grade, he protests. I paid money for this course. I should have a 4.0, and gets a sympathetic ear upstairs. See, I'm glad I'm not teaching now, because I could just picture, one, the political correctness that's so prevalent would create a serious problem for me. I mean, you can't be a satirist and fastball that back the PC police. But also, I would consider it a tough grader. Some students thought I was, but I don't think most of them thought that. But it's pretty damn hard to be a rigorous grader nowadays when you have to worry about the possibility that somebody in administration is going to hold that against you, or hell, maybe even change grades for all you can tell. So I think this has always been a place where I felt free to speak up however I wanted to, criticize my betters in administration, etc. Sometimes without adequate justification, I suppose. But I never felt threatened, and I never felt that my salary was held down because of my behavior. I knew how to get my salary up if I really wanted to. That was my main objective.
In looking back, or in thinking about this project in terms of documenting the undocumented as far as the university and commemoration of its history, is there anything that that you'd like to add to the record that maybe you hadn't thought of? And when someone says, well, I had Professor LaRue for an instructor. I remember him this way or anything like that.
Some of this is going to end up in print.
We hope so.
Well, I enjoyed teaching immensely, and I taught for 3 years at Yale. I had three sections each term on the quarter system, which were my sole responsibility as an assistant instructor. And when I went out to Utah, people would ask me, how do you compare the quality of students here with students at Yale? Well, I had to admit, Yale students, at least the general impression you got was, a great many of them had gone to prep school where they had reading to do in the summertime, long list of books they had to read. They knew a lot more about a lot of things as undergraduates than people at Utah did. But the good students at Utah could have held their own perfectly well at Yale. And that's true here, too. We've got students here who go on to prestigious grad schools and do well for themselves and do well after they get away, which confirms